What we're gonna do right here is go back. Way back. Back into time.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to another episode from the WWE Radio Archives. I am Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 792. And each week, I'm going to select an evergreen episode from the archives to share that maybe you haven't heard before, or one that you haven't heard in a long time, from interviews like this week to top tens, relevant reviews, guides, Wayback Machines, and more. It's a great way to visit and revisit some of our favorite episodes, including ones you have suggested that I share from the archives. And this week, I want to share an interview that goes back 17 years. Bill Sully Sullivan, a Disney legend whose career with the Walt Disney Company spanned nearly four decades, passed away earlier this week, and I thought it only appropriate to share my conversation with him from show 39 back in 2007. And his really is the remarkable story of starting as an opening day ticket taker at Disneyland and then rising through the ranks to hold many different significant roles, including overseeing the opening of Walt Disney World and Epcot. And in our conversation, Sully shares a lot of these remarkable stories and behind-the-scenes moments from working closely with Walt Disney, his experiences at the 1960 Winter Olympics, and some of his contributions to the design and operations of the Disney parks around the world. His journey literally was of a man who lived the Disney dream. And after you listen, I'd love to hear from you. Which of Sully's contributions to the Disney parks do you find the most impactful or most interesting? You can share your thoughts and be part of the community and conversation over in the Clubhouse at www.radio.com/clubhouse or call the voicemail. Share your thoughts there and I will play it on an upcoming episode of the show at 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1. And don't forget to visit www.radio.com for everything else, including blog, events, sign up for our free weekly email newsletter, and much more. Please connect and chat with me on social. I am at Lou Mangiello on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And visit loumangiello.com if you're looking for a speaker or if you are a creator, entrepreneur, or solopreneur looking to take your business, your brand, or idea to the next level and find out some of the ways that I can help you. We can work together. And about my Momentum series events, including my weekend workshop this fall in Walt Disney World. I'm announcing speakers and sessions next week, and you can still save $100 off your ticket. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode from the archives on the WDW Radio Show. As part of my continuing series where I get the wonderful opportunity to interview true Disney legends, my next special guest is a man whose career with Disney spanned almost four decades and whose story is truly remarkable. Some of us either have had or know of the dream of starting out at a company and moving on and up the ladder to eventually achieving something special on a completely different level. Well, my next special guest did just that while working for the Walt Disney Company. He's someone who has truly lived the dream by taking on a summer job as a ticket taker in Disneyland to eventually working for the company for 38 years in a number of different roles, including many at Walt Disney World. Those accomplishments led to him receiving Disney's highest honor, the naming of him of a Disney legend. So I'm pleased to welcome Bill Sully Sullivan to the WDW Radio Show.
Hello, and thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Well, thank you for coming on and taking a few minutes just to chat with me today. And
my pleasure.
Like I said during your introduction, I mean, you really have lived the dream of starting out as a young man who took on a summer job to somebody with his own window on Main Street. Tell us kind of how you started with the company.
Well, it was interesting because I was working in Anaheim, California, in the aircraft industry. At I can't remember the name of the place now. But the guy that interviewed me at Disneyland, Chuck Whalen, had just left there the weekend before, and so they hired me, and it gave the wardrobe mistress a little bit of a problem because I'm only 5'8" and I had a 34-inch waist, and I didn't fit the pattern it was turned out. But thank God for Lou, she took care of me, and she always adjusted my pants and stuff like that. But it was interesting because I got to start at the Jungle Cruise, the Jungle Cruise are all the deep guys. And you had to be somewhat of an extrovert, and nut to work on the Jungle Cruise because we took three trips an hour, or three trips and then take one off, and the trips lasted 7 minutes at that time, and so we'd get a quick break and then get back on the boats, and it was fun because we never knew what was going to happen, and we had the opportunity to help build the place like they gave us. When we started, we didn't have much of a script, so the guys all got together and kind of wrote our own script, and then they brought in a professional, and he tried to change it all, and we stayed with our own scripts because we liked them better, but you had to be somewhat of a rogue to be there, too. But we had some real characters. We had worked on the Jungle Cruise. We had a gentleman that had spent 15 years in Marrakesh in the oil fields. We had a gentleman, Don Weir, who was the first one to grow a beard, and he came in one morning and he had comedians tied around his neck on a little wire, and we had Tex, who was just a jockey. He would take, where a normal trip was 7 minutes, and his trips would last 4 minutes, and just stuff like that, and it was a bunch of nuts working there, really.
And this was very early on in actually, you know, the opening of Disney, because as the story goes, from what I understand, you basically, on Sunday night, you watch the opening ceremonies for Disneyland. Less than a week later, you go down and apply for a job.
The Disneyland opened on the 17th, and I went to work there on the 27th. And I spent 2.5 years in the jungle as a jungle bunny, and then had the opportunity to move around the park and work a lot of the different attractions, and then I was promoted to what we used to refer to as a yo-yo supervisor. We'd go up, we'd be promoted and go on salary in the peak periods because we couldn't afford to keep me up year-round, and there was about a half a dozen of us like that. And today we'd be a supervisor wearing a suit and tie, and tomorrow we'd be back in costume. And we did that for a couple of years, and finally in 59, when we did the rededication and opened the Matterhorn and the subs and the monorail, I was promoted on a permanent basis on Main Street as an assistant supervisor. And fortunately, I was at the right place at the right time, and I, you know, I guess I had the personality and the drive and the initiative to get promoted by up and away. Well, and yeah. In the meantime, you know, and going up, I got picked to go and do a couple of premieres up in Hollywood and crowd control, working with the press. We got to tour John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and a lot of the dignitaries that Walt would come down and host. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see our Russian friend, but that's all right. Was it Gorbachev? No, it wasn't Gorbachev. It was Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. We got picked for Squaw Valley. There was three of us that went up to Squaw Valley and worked up there for 6 weeks and security of the valley because they forgot to hire any security people, so we had to put together a team and ID, and we did that.
And that was for the Winter Olympics, the
1960 Winter Olympics up at Squaw Valley, up in Northern California. Great time. Learned a lot. Met some great people. That's where we met Willie Scheffler when we were going to be talking about doing the program up in the mountains that Walt wanted to build. But the Sierra Club shot us down and couldn't do that, so we went on from there. But then we got to go back to the World's Fair. Spent a year back there. I'd never been east of the Mississippi, and I got a phone come up from my boss one day, and he says, "Sully." He says, "Sell your house, both your cars, and be ready to go in 30 days. I said, "Where am I going?" He says, "You're going back to the World's Fair, and you're going to be the assistant manager of the four Disney World's Fairs shows back there." And so we went back, and my family and my kids were clean for 9 months because we lived in an apartment. And my oldest daughter started kindergarten in PS 99 in New York, and in Queens. And that was a great experience. Again, we met some great people and made some good friends and learned a lot.
I can only imagine, like you said, about the experience that you had, not only working at the parks, but being able to go outside the parks to things like the Olympics and to the World's Fair, that obviously would have long-lasting, you know, effects on the theme parks worldwide because of what Walt put there. And speaking of Walt, you know, how closely, if at all, did you work with Walt? And, you know, what was it like to work for him and with him?
Well, we always knew when Walt was around and gained a lot of knowledge just through osmosis and from what we heard and what we saw. And when we were in the early days of Disneyland, our operating hours were from 9 to 9, and we worked 7 days a week. It was us for a 7-day shift. And it was interesting because those foggy California nights would come aboard, and you couldn't see across Main Street, and Walt would be just down walking the park and seeing what was going on. We'd be sitting around there, and there'd be nobody in the park hardly. And so Walt would come down and sit on the boats and shoot the breeze with the guys and just see what our attitudes were and what our opinions were. And he got to look at us, and we were kind of the reprobates of Disneyland. And we helped start the guys on the Jungle Cruise, helped start the grooming standards down there because he didn't like our haircuts and our beards and our mustaches. So, but he was a neat guy. He knew what he wanted, and he talked to people. And it was interesting to watch him because he didn't want people to do special things for him. He would just want to walk the park, and if he was dressed up in his blue suit and his Smoke Tree Ranch tie, he was just out visiting the guests. And if he had his blue pinstripe pants on, his old leather jacket and his boondockers and his straw hat, he was working. And he'd go over to Tom Sawyer Island, or he'd go out in the painted desert and look things over, and then go back to the designers and design something new. But it was interesting. It was you always knew when he was around, though, because the guy's security would call in and a word would go out over the radio that there was a code W. That meant Walt was in the park, or a code R. That meant Roy was in the park. But the studio would always call us and say, he's on his way down. And about 35, 40 minutes later, he'd be arriving at the Harbor Gate or at West Street Gate. And so we always knew when he was around. And it was interesting because he would pop in and talk, and it was interesting because people would see him in his blue suit, and they'd crowd around him for autographs and stuff like that. And we'd walk up and say, "Mr. Disney, this way, please." And he'd correct it. He says, "My name's Walt, not Mr. Disney. There's only one Mr. at Disneyland. That's Mr. Toad. And later on, it was Mr. Lincoln, too." But he was a good guy, and he'd appreciate it. And we'd walk him out the back, and he'd come out another gate and go see the park someplace else. He'd wander the park at night. I worked graveyard for 8 months in graveyard security. And I'm rambling a lot, but it just popped into my mind that I get this call over the radio. I'm sitting in the office and by the dispatcher, and there was a security host out in the park. And he says, "Hey, there's some guy out here who says he's Walt Disney." He was a brand new guy. And this was like, you know, after midnight, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "Uh-oh." So I jumped on my bike and I ran out there where he was, and it was sure Walt. And Walt looked up and said, "Oh, God, Sully, God, thank God it's you." He said, "This guy's about to arrest me." So we walked him up to his apartment up above Main Street, up above the fire station, and said good night. But he's a great guy. He was a very warm individual person like that.
And everybody that I ever have spoken to about that knew Walt described him exactly the same way, that he wasn't, you know, what you might perceive as being, you know, your boss or an executive. He was very warm, and he was very, he didn't look down on anybody. He cared about what everybody thought and their opinions and treated everybody with respect.
And when he, you know, it's interesting you say that, because when he'd come and see us, you know, and when it was slower, you know, there's nothing going on, he'd say, "Well, what do you think about this?" But he did that at the studio also. There was one guy that he worked with, we heard, that he was a janitor in the animation building. And Walt would go up to him, he'd go up to him and say, "Well, what do you think about this, Rufus? What do you think about these?" And he said, "Well, I was looking at some films, and some of the boys are doing some pretty good work, and maybe..." It was funny, but he would talk to everybody and get opinions.
It's wonderful. I mean, obviously, you know, clearly everybody, the one thing everybody says too is, like you said, he knew what he was doing, and being able to draw from people that had the firsthand experience in the parks or at the studios.
Not only that, but he would walk the park and he would stand and he would smoke a cigarette and lean on a trash can, and people would walk up to him and say, "Hi, Mr. Disney," and he'd sign their autograph. He'd say, "Well, did you have a good time today?" Or he'd strike up a conversation with them. "Well, what can we do to make it better? How can I make you happy?" And he talked to the guests and said, "You know, how can we make it better for you? Not for him, but for you." And you know, that was important. Like he always said, take care of the guests, they'll take care of you.
You know, as you tell that story, a smile was coming on my face, and I'm sure on listeners as well, because you can't fathom, you know, seeing Walt Disney in the park and walking, not only walking up to him and getting his autograph, but him saying, "Well, what do you think? You know, are you having a good time? Or what do you think about this?" You know, and that Walt obviously cared and took your opinion, and it had an impact on what he did in the future.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But after the World's Fair in 64 and 65, at some point you were once again relocated, and this time to Florida. When and why did the company move you down there?
Well, the word got out at the World's Fair that something was happening on the East Coast. Nobody knew what it was, and that's when Walt Disney World was called Project X, and Bob Foster was down there buying properties, And it was announced that we were going to do something in Florida, and I told the boss, I said, "I'd like to be one of the first guys down there." He says, "No," he says, "you got too much to learn." So I went back to Disneyland, and that was in 64, or 65 rather, and I got moved around a lot, and I got a lot of training, and I got a lot of exposure, and it came one day that I was moved over from as manager of Fantasyland to project development, and that's where we started providing input into WDI, or at that time it was called WED, stood for Walter Elias Disney, for operating input into WED for Walt Disney World and for the Magic Kingdom particularly. And I got to work on the design and the layout of Fantasyland, because that was my area. And unfortunately, we had it, Rolly Crump and I, we had it laid out beautifully, and we were starting to run out of money, so we had to shrink things down some. So that's how we got that little narrow passageway over there. It was shrunk too much. but then we, you know, I was sent down here to do different jobs. Or for Joe Fox. My title was, I was senior staff assistant to the vice president. And I meant I was a high-priced gopher. So I did a little bit of everything. I came down and set up the post office down here for Walt Disney World and for Joe Feller and the construction. I came down and I went to work for the hotel company for a while. And we took over the Hilton in South on International Drive to get some exposure to the guests that were here and purchasing and marketing of the different stuff. I came down and helped open up the preview center with Holscher, and just very sundry things. And I did the first, Legislators Weekend. I did that for Jack Lindquist. And so I just did a lot of different stuff, and that was fun, because I got to get exposed to a lot of different people, a lot of different things, got to do a lot of different stuff.
Right, and you clearly had a hand in so many of the different elements that ended up becoming Walt Disney World. And like I said, you mentioned Fantasyland. I didn't even realize that you had such a hand in the design and the layout of Fantasyland.
Well, I designed the main gate, the main entrance of the park, not only the park, but for the ticket sales, then for the park, and then... like the width of Main Street. The Main Street is 12 feet wider than the one in Disneyland, because we wanted to be able to do bigger and better parades and wanted to have more sidewalk. So we added a few feet here and a few feet there and made it easier for our guests to get up and down the street and still do our parades. Hmm. So, yeah, I got to do a lot of different stuff. And obviously, I was on that 3-4 years, something like that. And then when I was assigned to the hotel company, I moved down here. And then about 6 months later, I was assigned to security and fire prevention, and we hired all the first 75 security hosts that we had and set up security and set up a liaison with the fire department and the local sheriff's department and, you know, just different stuff like that. So I had fun. I learned a lot.
I mean, I got to just go off on a tangent for a little bit because going back to when you first started with the company, you were 19 or so, correct?
I was 19 years old.
Now, you've done all these different things. You have all these different roles in the company, from ticket taker to everything else that you've described. Was your background in anything that may have given you a leg up, or did you get basically all of your experience and training while you worked for the company?
I worked on, when I was in high school, my major was architecture. I worked at my uncle's chicken ranch for 4 years during high school, and then for a year after I got out of high school. And finally, he said, go get a grill job. So I went to work in the aircraft industry. And I did that for 6, 8 months, a year, something like that. And you know, I was used to working outside and enjoying the sun. And I was in a building all day. And you work, you know, from 7 to 3:30. And you got a break in the morning and 1 in the afternoon and lunch. And otherwise, you were at the, you know, if you wanted to go to the restroom, you had to ask your boss. I didn't like that. So I found me another job, and I went to interview with Chuck Whalen, and he hired me. And 39 and a half years later, I retired.
I'll say, clearly it worked out pretty well for you. So.
Yeah, I had a good time. We worked hard and played hard.
But, you know, you stayed down in Florida, and you were there for not only the opening of Walt Disney World and the Magic Kingdom, you were also there for the opening of Epcot, and obviously we were just celebrating the 25th anniversary a couple of weeks ago, so this
right.
is something
I
that...
Out, they invited me out for that, and I went out for that.
Right now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I worked on Epcot Center for 4 years prior to its opening, and again, I was back providing operational input into the attractions and all that, and then we had, when we got, we started developing an inventory system for the show installation, and I was in charge of Pico also, and I had another couple guys working for me that we promoted later on. But I was at opening of Epcot Center. I was in charge of all the operations, and that was fun. And anything that happened, or any of the other divisions that wanted to do something for Epcot, went through me, and we went to WDI or WED at the time. And we gave them this input, and it was, you know, and the boss says, you know, it's your baby, and you're going to run it, so you make it right. And don't give me any bitching about how it goes. And so that's why I got involved in doing that, and I got to know a lot of other good people in the other divisions. And we assigned each division, which there was 9 of, they assigned somebody to give me the input, and then we'd go together and we'd go to WDI and we'd give them that kind of input and the design. I didn't approve any of the designs or, you know, if it didn't, but if I didn't like it or it didn't work with the operating areas, we'd make some changes. And then, I did that for 4 years, and I ran it for 2 years, and I went back to the Magic Kingdom and spent 10 years in the Magic Kingdom. Primarily running the Magic Kingdom and doing a lot of training, and that was one of my main thrusts at the end. There was training our new people,
and that was back in 1987, right? You became vice president of Magic Kingdom.
Yes.
One question: I want to go back to the opening of Epcot real quick because I had heard that and this is something that I've never seen before, I've never heard it, but that an interview was conducted during the opening ceremonies with Walt's widow, Lillian, who,
that's correct.
I understand, normally did not give interviews, but you were the person that made that happen, is that right?
That's correct. The boss wasn't around, and that, you know, that Mrs. Disney had a great influence on what took place in the company in the early days, and then, you know, how she'd keep Walt straight, and just like all wives do, their husbands. And so I talked to Bob Allen Jr. I says, let's do a film with Mrs. Disney. And he said, you know, she's never been interviewed. We don't have any interviews with her. I said, well, all she could say is no. So, and Diane was there, Lillian was there, and their oldest granddaughter was there. And so I asked Diane, I said, what would your mom think about doing an interview with us? And she says, well, what's it for? And I says, well, for posterity, and we'd show it to our people, and so they could get to know your mom. And she says, let's go ask. So she was in a golf cart touring before opening, and she says, Sully, ask mom. So I says, Mrs. Disney, and I laid it on her, and she says, who's it for? And I says, well, I'm asking you, and it's for something I can show my people and show the young guys and gals coming up. And she says, it's not for the press. I said, no, ma'am. And I said, I guarantee you that. And she says, okay. And so we set it up that we did it at 8 o'clock one morning in the gardens of the English Pavilion, which were gorgeous. And Mrs. Disney was there, Diane was there, and your oldest granddaughter, Jean.
Jenny?
Something like
was
that.
It Jenny?
I don't remember.
Yeah, maybe.
Jenny or something. I don't, it was the oldest granddaughter. And she was a sweetheart. And Bob Allen conducted the interviews. And I finally found the tape. I was talking to one guy at the NFFC convention, and he says, well, I've got the tape. I says, no. And now this is going back to, what, 25 years ago?
Right.
We did that tape. I'd never seen it in 25 years.
No kidding.
And he says, here it is. I went to a meeting the other night. He says, here's that tape you've been looking for. So I've got it on my desk, and I'm going to review it and take a look at it.
Wow.
So that's the only tape I know of that is of Mrs. Disney, and I've never seen it before.
I was going to say, that's never been shown to the public, has it?
Absolutely not.
Wow. You want to talk about it? You want to talk about not only a wonderful opportunity to set up the interview, but to now have the what may be the only tape in existence of it is amazing.
I think we sent one to Diane, but and probably Sharon,
mm-hmm.
When she was alive. But as far as I know, that's the only ones I know of.
Wow.
We checked with Dave Smith in the archives. He didn't have one.
Hmm.
So anyway.
And I assume you won't be putting that up on eBay anytime soon.
I don't think so.
So, in addition to working at Disneyland, I mean,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's right. I promise you that you will sell one. I will be the very first to purchase one. But you almost opened Disneyland for all intents and purposes, and the Magic Kingdom in Walt Disney World, and Epcot, and the World's Fair. You also worked overseas as well for Paris and Tokyo.
I did a lot of training for Jim for Tokyo. I was asked to go, and I said I didn't want to go. And when he got Jim Cora, who used to work for me at Disneyland, he was promoted as vice president over there for Disneyland International. That's where the outfit that handled all of our overseas parks. And Jim called me one day. He said, this is part of the opening of Paris, or during the construction of Paris. He says, Sully, he says, come help me open this park. He says, you and I are the only ones that have ever opened a park before, and I don't have enough help. I said, nah, Jim, I don't want to. I've got a good job. You know, I was a mayor of Disneyland. I wanted them to make me king, but they wouldn't do that. So I had a good job, and I was vice president of the Magic Kingdom at Walt Disney World. I had a great job. And so he says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, come over, spend a week, bring your wife, and we'll just look at the project.
Famous last words, right?
yeah. I said, I'll do that for you. And I got to Paris, and, you know, it was dark and dreary and rainy, and wait for us, Jackie. And so he says, no, but she was excited because my wife would do anything, any traveling that I asked her to do, and because she never unpacked her bags. But we... he was rotten because we walked down the gate from between Hills Brothers and the balloon shop, and turned the corner in front of the Kodak shop, looking down Main Street, and saw the castle down there at the other end. And it was absolutely gorgeous. that's the most beautiful castle we've ever built, the one in Paris. And I said, oh, stuff. And I said, you're rotten, Cora. I says, I'll be here. And so I called my boss, and we sat down, and he said, well, go ahead and finish your week and come on back. So I said, you know, he needs help. I'm more than happy to go with him. And we figured out who would take my spot and ran the park while I was gone. And I said, you know, don't have a phone call away. And he says, how long are you going to be gone? I says, 6-7 months, maybe 8. And he says, well, we need it. And Bob, being a great company guy, he knew that we needed the help. And he says, okay. And so he told Nunes, who was my big boss, what we wanted to do. And he says, okay. So as of January 1st, I jumped on the airplane and flew to Paris and spent 7 months in Paris opening that up. Now, that was an interesting experience. It was cold, rainy, snowy, cold. Ah, never been so cold in my life. Come to find out, the Marne la Vallée, where the park is, was called the Refrigerator of Paris. And but it's a gorgeous park, and it was beautifully done. The designers did a magnificent job. Went way overboard on it, but hey, that's what Michael and Frank wanted, and they got it, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. You know, I haven't been over there in 15 years, so I hope it's as good, if not better than it was. Landscaping. Luke Baer, who came over and studied under Katie Warner, who was my horticulturist at Walt Disney World, Luke Baer is French-Canadian, and he was hired to be their landscaper over there. And so Luke came over and studied with us and worked with us for about 6 months and then went over to Paris and did a magnificent job in landscaping that park and maintaining it, too.
And like I said, I've heard as well about the castle just being absolutely magnificent and the park really coming into its own and being a very beautiful place to kind of walk through. But when you start talking about other parks that are beautiful and accomplishments that Disney's done with their parks, Tokyo comes to mind because everybody I know that's gone over to Tokyo has come back just awestruck at how beautiful Tokyo is and
it's
Tokyo Disney Sea.
It's beautiful because it's got its own little personality. And it's got all these neat little Japanese guys and gals running around taking care of the place. And Main Street is covered over like an arcade, and which gives it a different feel. And the food is phenomenal over there. And the merchandise, they've done an interesting thing with their merchandise. And so they do their... each one of the parks has its own personality. And they were designed that way. And people say, well, you know, which park do you like the best? You know, of course I love the Magic Kingdom, and of course I love the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland. You know, and I'm closer to the Disneyland and the Magic Kingdom and Walt Disney World and Paris. So, you know, and let's face it, Walt touched the one that touched Disneyland, and nobody else, and that, you know, that made it what it was, or what it is.
Very true.
Yeah. But
I can only imagine that in the 38-year-plus career that you had at the company, the amount of amazing stories that you can and probably can't tell. But if you had to pick one, of the most memorable stories or moments or funniest things that's happened to you in your career, what do you think that would be?
Well, it's very simple as far as I'm concerned. It's that there was a young lady working across the Jungle Cruise that was a cute little blonde. And she was wearing a Hawaiian skirt, and the 11th of October we celebrated our 49th anniversary, and married my wife out of Disneyland, and that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And but there was a lot of stuff, you know. We flew Tinkerbell at Disney at the Walt Disney World, which we'd always wanted to do and never could figure out how to do it. But me and Arnold Lindbergh and Hank Danes, we bootlegged it and it worked. You know, and just being affiliated with the opening of in 59, we being affiliated with the opening of Epcot Center and Walt Disney World, you put them all in one big basket. You know, and I had 39-year great run. And as far as I'm concerned, we had the golden years of the Disney parks. And so, there's not one particular thing I can say that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me except marrying my wife out of there.
I was going to say, you talk about living the dream. Not only are you working at Disneyland, but you meet your wife there. So it doesn't get any better than that.
And four beautiful kids later.
There you go. And it gets even better because you retire in 1993. In 2005, you're inducted as a Disney legend, arguably the highest honor the company can give to any of its cast members. Now, more importantly, you hold a very, very rare distinction of having not one, but two windows on Main Street USA. Tell me how you're able to swing that one, because you have Sully's Safaris and Guide Service, where you're the chief guide, and the Windermere Fraternal Hall, which I'm going to ask you about specifically as well.
The one was that they were trying to fill up windows on Main Street when they did the first one with the Windermere guys. But then I was really pleased when I retired that they gave me my own window on Sully's Safaris, because I'm a hunter and fisherman and good stuff like that. And I was honored that way as my own two windows on Main Street. And I was always envious of the guys that were Disney legends, but I respected those that were, because that's a pretty strong group, with the Nine Old Men, with the John Henches and all those good guys that, really started the whole company. Mm-hmm. And when Michael called me and said, "Sully, you're going to be receiving a letter in the mail that's we want to make you honor you as being a Disney legend," I just fell right through it. And my wife said, "I've never seen you speechless." And when you read that letter, you were speechless. And I didn't give a big speech because my reception of the honor, because I didn't know what to say. I was so awestruck with being made a Disney legend. It's really a great honor as far as I'm concerned.
And very well deserved, obviously.
Oh, thank you.
But I want to ask you specifically about the other window is the Windermere Fraternal Hall. It says lodge meetings every Friday, and the charter members are Bob Allen, Pete Cummings, Dick Evan, Bill Holscher, Bob Mathiasen, and you, Bill Sullivan. Now, Bob Allen was...
Bob Mathiasen and Jack Olson.
Oh, you're right, I missed one.
Those are just a bunch of fun-loving guys who were just us. The guys that had been with the company for a long time, and we all lived in Windermere, and I think they just filled up a window. Every 11, another window.
I have tried researching and finding out what the Windermere Fraternal Hall reference was. I said, did these guys get together? Did they meet up every Friday for a drink after work? Or is it just, it's just the fact that
several
you guys...
Several drinks after work. And a lot of us used to fish together and party together and work together, and our families grew up together and all that good stuff. So it's just a bunch of good guys.
Okay. Do you still live in Florida? You get a chance to get out to the parks at all?
I do go out to the parks occasionally, but it's been quite a while. I don't work there anymore, and if I go out there, I'd get upset and I'd start raising hell with somebody. And I don't work there anymore. And I agree with some of the things they do, and I disagree with some of the things they do. But it's not my park anymore. It belongs to Philip and McPhee and Mike. So I don't go out there.
Now
the parks are beautiful.
Yeah, we actually met on the eve of Epcot's 25th up in the Canada Pavilion, and having just celebrated the anniversary and you having such close ties to the park, how do you think it compares today to what it was in 1982?
Like I said, they run their park the way they want to. I run my park. Ran my park the way I want to.
Very diplomatic answer. Bravo. But finally, Mr. Sullivan, my last question is: what do you think? Again, your history with the company is so storied and so remarkable, and such a variety of different roles and positions that you had. What do you think you're really most proud of, looking back?
I was proud of the crew that I had. Because, and the people ask me today, well, what do you miss out there? Do you miss, I said, I miss my park, but I don't miss the meetings. I don't miss the politics. I don't miss the infighting, and I miss my people. Because I had 7,500 of the greatest employees, that any guy could have. And, I had almost 400 salaried people They're a great bunch of people. They worked hard, played hard, and you know, and they were just good people. And they carried on the Disney tradition the way it should have been, the way we trained them how to do it. And I was very proud of them. So yeah, that's my people.
Well, you know, everything that you said kind of is the same theme that resonates through everyone that I speak to, because the first thing they do is they give credit to the people that worked with them and around them. And kind of, you're talking about tradition, I guess that kind of is carrying on the tradition of what Walt did. Walt was a genius in the fact that he knew to surround himself with people that were incredibly talented and people from whom he could pull even more talent that they knew that they had.
Walt had a philosophy, and he Walt would say that, you know, we can design, build, and create the greatest park in the world, but without the people, they're nothing. And that's absolutely right. Because, you know, the people make the magic. It's, you know, the people are the ones that take care of the guests. When the kid falls down, they pick him up. When a kid gets lost, they pick him up and find their mama and daddy again. The one that ushers them on to the attractions and helps them. And it's the people that makes it work.
I wholeheartedly agree with you 100%. The cast members are what make Walt Disney World and everything that Disney does is so truly magical. So, Mr. Sullivan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It's always an honor to have the opportunity to chat with somebody who, like I said, is truly a Disney legend. And on behalf of myself and every other guest that continues to enjoy what you helped create, I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you, and I appreciate the honor.
Take care.
Thank you.